From Radio Vermont, it's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV. It's your show about the people, places, and the issues that matter the most to you. Now here's your host, Dave Graham.
Good morning, Vermont. It is Wednesday, June the 24th, 2020, and we have a good show lined up for you this morning. We are going to be talking in the first 45 minutes or so about legislation that would ban the chokehold, use of the chokehold by police officers in Vermont. Of course, chokeholds have become really notorious and around the country after the George Floyd killing in Minneapolis. And of course, that wasn't the first time that someone had been killed by a police officer without by basically being denied the ability to breathe. Another famous case was the Eric Garner case in New York City a few years ago. And that was the first time that the phrase "I can't breathe" really became famous, because that's what Mr. Garner was trying to tell Officer Pantaleo, as Officer Pantaleo had his arm around Mr. Garner's throat and was denying Mr. Garner the ability to breathe, eventually killing Mr. Garner. And George Floyd had the knee on his neck, also being denied the ability to breathe. We're going to be talking with one of the people heavily involved in this legislation in Vermont. Senator Dick Sears is the chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee here. Also, I think we're going to be hearing from John Howe. He is a member of the Vermont State Employees Association. He is a state worker who is really strongly supportive of this ban. There's a lot of consternation in the union. The other day, a trainer from the Vermont Police Academy in Pittsford was representing the Vermont State Employees Association, testifying in front of the Senate Judiciary Committee. Drew Bloom, longtime police trainer in Vermont, was saying he does not want to see the chokehold banned. He does not want to see the use of chokehold subject to a criminal penalty in Vermont, which I'm pretty sure this legislation contemplates. So we can talk to Senator Sears about that in just a couple minutes. And the police trainer, Drew Bloom, was saying that there are rare occasions when somebody is in a very close quarters fight, and for instance, you're both reaching for a weapon that has been dislodged. Say there's a gun on the ground, and the police officer and the suspect are both reaching for the gun, and the police officer might want to use his hands on the suspect's throat to prevent the suspect from getting the gun. And would not want to be forbidden and criminally penalized for doing something like that. So we can talk all about that with Senator Sears. First, I want to mention that later on in the program, we're going to be talking about the subject of ATV safety. ATV crashes have tripled in Vermont so far this year compared to the same time period last year. We're going to be talking with an injury prevention expert, Abby Bierman from the University of Vermont Medical Center. They issued a statement the other day talking about ATV safety and making recommendations. We also were going to be speaking with Danny Hale. He is the president of the VASA, as it's known, the Vermont ATV Sportsmen's Association. And we'll be having that conversation in the second hour of the program. I believe we're also going to have a conversation with Ken Squire, the longtime owner of WDEV Radio, and who is a well-known broadcaster of NASCAR events. Ken Squire has some stuff he wants to tell us about recent developments with NASCAR. Of course, it's been much in the national news recently as it has tried to turn away from a history which many people see as being somewhat steeped in racism and so on. Confederate flags have been banned at NASCAR events, for instance. And we'll be talking with Ken about that at in the latter part of this hour. Okay, well, let's get right into it with Senator Dick Sears, Democrat of Bennington County, longtime chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee. Senator Sears, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
David, thank you for having me. It's certainly a timely and important subject.
Yeah, and so tell us what about this legislation. What is the bill? Report the bill for us. Pretend you're on the Senate floor. Tell us about
it. Let me try to cover a couple of issues before we get into maybe questions.
Okay.
If you look at the Fourth Amendment to the United States Constitution, it's the right of people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures. shall not be violated and no warrants shall issue, but upon probable cause supported by oath or affirmation, and particularly describing the place to be searched and the persons or things to be seized. So when you have, over the years, as the U.S. Supreme Court and in some cases Vermont Supreme Court has looked at the use of force, it's been guided by the Fourth Amendment. And in a particularly in the Graham case in the U.S. Supreme Court, they established what's called a reasonable officer standard. Mm-hmm. And that reasonable officer standard in terms of use of force is what guides currently legislation both in the state and federal level. And that standard is coming under fire. And part of that, the reason for that, is reading now from an earlier draft of S-219, the authority to use physical force is a serious responsibility that shall be exercised judiciously with respect for human rights and dignity and for the sanctity of every human life. Every person has a right to be free from excessive use of force by officers. That statement, I think, is an important one in understanding how we got to where we are. The Senate Judiciary Committee's version of S-219, adopted unanimously yesterday by the full Senate, prohibits improper restraints, meaning what's prohibited is the use of any maneuver on a person that applies pressure to the neck, throat, windpipe, or carotid artery that may prevent or hinder breathing, reduce intake of air, or impede the flow of blood or oxygen to the brain. So when we say chokehold, that's not how it's described in the bill that we just passed, although it, in a sense, means the same thing. There are two sanctions for a prohibited restraint. One would be where there is no death or serious bodily injury, and it could be a Category B conduct offense that the Criminal Justice Training Council would look at, and a person could be removed, fired, etc., and dealt with that way. If serious bodily injury or death results from a prohibited restraint, then that officer could face up to 20 years in prison, plus other charges, including not limited to murder, manslaughter, etc. So this, what we've tried to do is I think, allow for a case-by-case review by the courts of any case that came before it. So the concerns that have been expressed by the gentleman from the training council, I think, is addressed, frankly, by a case-by-case review of anything that happens. Mm-hmm. Obviously, if the his description, I believe, was an officer struggling when a person who's been subject to arrest tries to grab his gun or something like that, and he's placed in danger, he still has all the rights accorded to any citizen for that kind of review as to the totality of the case. So I think, and as you look at what other states have done, in talking with police and others, and quite frankly, in my own experience, as you know, I was an executive director of a program for troubled youth, and mm-hmm. we had to be taught restraint. And, you know, I retired in 2006, so I received, before I retired, actually, restraint training that was clearly do not use any kind of chokehold or any kind of restraint that would inhibit the person's ability to breathe. And it just was, so how anyone could look at what happened in Minneapolis and try to justify that is beyond me, frankly.
Well, I don't think anyone. I don't think anyone has done that. And Drew Bloom from the Criminal Justice Training Council and Vermont Police Academy was very clear that he thought that that action by the officer Derek Chauvin in Minneapolis was horrible. I think that was the word he used. And by the way, I was hoping to get Drew Bloom on the program this morning. He is tied up today, unable to join us. But I talked with him at length yesterday afternoon, and I listened to his testimony. I believe it was last Thursday in your committee, Senator. Yep. Sears, and he, you know, he has a definite point of view here. One of the interesting aspects of this, of course, is that there, you know, where he comes from, representing state employees, he was actually there, from what I understand, as a witness for the Vermont State Employees Association, the state workers union, and took this stance against the legislation banning chokeholds. Obviously quite controversial. There are many union members who favor such legislation and think that this conduct by police needs very badly to be reined in and so on. So there's significant division, from what I understand, in the ranks of the SEA. And I actually reached out to the VSEA leadership in the last couple of days to see whether they might like to join us on the program this morning. They declined. They don't want to, I guess, come on the radio and talk about all this right now. Right. And so your legislation definitely is striking a nerve here, Senator. And I gather that many Vermonters out there would be supportive of it. You certainly seem to have a pretty strong support in the legislature. What is the process like right now? I mean, I gather this is something that is originating in your committee.
Mike,
go ahead.
It'll be voted on what's called third reading today, and the bill will then go to the House Judiciary Committee. We've been working very closely with Representative Grad, the chair of that committee, and Speaker Johnson on the path for this legislation. And so S-219, I expect, will get to the governor's desk before we adjourn until August. S-119, which has to do with the use of deadly force, will be viewed by the House Judiciary Committee, and it has an effective date of October 1st, and should get to the governor when we come back in August, after the House Judiciary Committee's had time to look at that bill. So I
see
that the House will support the bill that was voted on 30-0 yesterday, but 28-0, I should say. Two senators weren't able to make it yesterday to the meeting of the Senate. And I want to also explain that in the bill, in terms of use of force, two things are certainly first and foremost. One is the necessary. Is the restraint necessary? And the second is proportionality. Is the restraint proportional to the crime that has been alleged? For example, in the case in Minneapolis, we have an individual who was accused of passing a $20 counterfeit bill that somehow ends up in a restraint, an improper restraint, witnessed by three other officers and engaged in by three other officers, as well as the officer who was charged with murder. And so was that proportional to the threat? And that's another issue that I think is missed by those who are opposing the bill. You need to look at what was the danger posed by Mr. Floyd. And also Rashad Brooks in Atlanta. He was accused of a DUI. 45 minutes went on. And there you have a case similar to the one, while he didn't grab the weapon, during the restraint, which I must add was poorly done by the Atlanta police, if I view the tape, then they already had control of his vehicle. They had control to some extent. He was running away, and they fired three shots, two which have hit him in the back and one that hit him an occupied vehicle waiting in line at the Wendy's. So you have to question the proportionality of the restraint, of the use of deadly force, and look at it from that perspective. Was the crime, did that fit that? On the other hand...
Senator, let me give you a little bit of pushback here, just for the sake of argument. And you know, I'm not really advocating one position or another here. I'm just sort of trying to probe this topic a little bit. And it goes like this. I can imagine one counter argument being that, it looks like a guy getting killed for passing a fake $20 bill is way out of proportion. I think most Americans would agree on that. But you could have a case where somebody is being confronted by the police in a very, very petty crime like this, and then during that confrontation with the police, the person starts acting in an aggressive or assaultive way toward the officers, and then they are not so much responding to the passing of a fake $20 bill, they are responding to somebody who is getting violent with them, and that really is an escalation which kind of moves it into a different realm. I mean, I understand the horror of people thinking this guy died for passing a fake $20 bill, or Eric Garner in New York died for selling, I guess, single cigarettes without a license or something. Right. You know, incredibly petty crimes for what ended up being the result. But what the officers would undoubtedly say was, you know, once you're in a fight with a guy and he's swinging at you or whatever we think he's doing, that goes way beyond passing a fake $20 bill. You see what I mean?
Yes, I do, and I don't disagree with you that it can get to that point. That's why the Vermont Police Academy and others teach de-escalation, and so you try not to get to that point.
Yep.
In my own training, de-escalation is the number one method. There are times when police need to use deadly force. We recognize that. Mm-hmm. When they are a danger to somebody else, who they may... we had a case in Arlington where a person was firing at will at police officers from home during a domestic dispute. That is much different from the cases that we're talking about where restraint is being used. And again, if an officer, obviously they don't have the benefit of hindsight, I should have done it this way, I'm looking at this, blah, blah, blah. But the proper training and so forth. And I don't envy a law enforcement officer's job right now. It's extremely difficult. This is just one piece of changes that I think both Vermonters and those of the United States and, quite frankly, all around the world, as we see the demonstrations, are asking us to look at.
One of the things that Drew Bloom from the Criminal Justice Training Council testified to in your committee the other day and was quite emphatic about with me on the phone yesterday. I think we spoke for about a half an hour yesterday. And Mr. Bloom was basically making the argument that the Vermont police training is better than it is in a lot of other parts of the country, and that our officers here, by and large, are being better trained. They're gonna perform better out in the streets and so on. What do you think? Do you think that there is sort of daylight between the training that Vermont police officers get versus what is sort of the national average or standard or however you want to describe it?
Well, that's part of the problem is we don't really have the data to back up anything like that. Mm-hmm. Anecdotally, when a police officer acts badly, we hear about it. We don't hear about the perhaps 95% to 99% of police officers who go about and do their job in a very effective way and serve the public. So, for example, when a Burlington police officer pushes a person of color in Burlington, I think it was the Balavance situation, we hear about that, but we don't hear about the thousands of other interactions that go on between law enforcement. I think that there are places where our law enforcement is excellent, and I think there are places where we have problems. So I think it's hard to say, make a blanket statement that we're ahead of California or New York or whatever. I do think, I look at the police, the report, for example, of the Bennington Police Department, my own hometown police department, by the National Association of Chiefs of Police, and their recommendations for improvement. I don't think there's any question that every police department in the country and in Vermont can handle some improvement, but I won't make a blanket statement.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying, and obviously there's always room for improvement almost in any endeavor. And, so that is that's not surprising that you would see it that way, let me ask you this: are you surprised that that there is this pushback from some in law enforcement in Vermont, and are you surprised that there is appears to be significant division over this issue, even among the members of the State Employees Association?
No, I'm not. Change is always difficult, and even though you talk to law enforcement and they say we haven't been using this, I think the chief in New York City or wherever that alleged chokehold occurred this weekend, that didn't result in serious bodily injury or death, by the way. We haven't used chokeholds since 1980 something or other. Well, there's an allegation that one of the officers was. And, I understand the pushback, because when you hear, we don't use it, we don't train it, we don't do it. And then you see it.
And sometimes these reactions are almost, I don't know, these are human beings and reacting in the moment. Hey, Senator Sears, I'm hoping you can stay with us a little bit longer after the break. Maybe not for the whole second half hour, but for some of it. And I'd like to put this out there to listeners. Are you able to do that?
Pardon me?
Are you able to take some listener calls after the break?
Yeah, I can listen to some. I need to get done by about quarter of.
I think we can do that. So we'll be back shortly, folks, and continue our conversation with Senator Dick Sears of Bennington County. We'll be back shortly.
We're opening upstairs at the Warren store. Following CDC guidelines, we will allow 3 people at a time from 10 to 4 Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, and 11 to 3 Monday and Thursday until further notice. Or you can email Lori, L-O-R-I, at warrenstore.com to make an appointment. There's lots of great summer clothing at 50% off outside and new spring merchandise upstairs. Please wear a mask. We have disposables, and we will be selling organic wired ones from Product Think Tank. We'd love to see you. Stay safe. Main Street, Warren Village.
Now back to the Dave Graham Show on WDEV, FM, and AM.
Should Vermont pass a law saying that police are barred from using chokeholds in all instances, and if they do so and it's ruled to be improper, penalty could be 20 years in prison for the offending police officer? That's the question before us today. Senator Richard Sears, Dick Sears, is my guest. He's been with us. He's going to stay with us for a few more minutes, we've been talking about. He's the chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee. They worked up, drafted the bill that would do this. It's up for final approval in the Senate, and we'll move over to the House after that. Going to welcome some calls from listeners, I hope, would love to hear from folks out there what you think about this. 244-1777 is the local number in Waterbury. The toll-free number is 1-877-291-8255. And also have on the line with us John Howe. He is a member of the Vermont State Employees Association, and I have been mentioning them and some division within the union ranks because I actually first came onto this issue when I saw a Facebook post by John Howe the other day, pretty emphatically saying that he was upset that some in the VSEA were opposed to the proposed ban on chokeholds in particular. Chokeholds, of course, have become infamous following the cases of George Floyd in Minneapolis, his death, the death of Eric Garner in New York, other instances in which police officers have used chokeholds to try to get control of suspects. It's a dangerous, very, very dangerous move. You're denying somebody the ability to breathe, and that results, certainly did for Mr. Floyd and Mr. Garner, results in death sometimes. John Howe, thank you for calling in this morning. Tell me about your position on this and what you think about what your comrades in the VSEA are doing.
Good morning, Dave. Yes, I was just struck by how the union could be arguing against this reform. And I got dug in a little bit about how the decision-making, I think it was a breakdown in decision-making at the union and our democratic processes. So just to recap, we had a member from the supervisory union, someone who teaches at the police academy, testifying against the bill, S-219, and saying that in some cases and he didn't use the word chokehold, they use the word neck holds. A little bit of nuancing about it, that they have policy against that, but they don't want to see a law criminalizing that or holding police liable for using unnecessary force. So, and then our executive director testified, according to this article, 7 days, so a bit more bigger, that we should try to do this right, which I agree, but his effort was to stall it, stymie the legislation by moving it into a summer study, which is often kills things because the moment is now for this. It's very right to do this kind of change in reform. So I was surprised by that move, in part because just weeks ago, the board of trustees for the union had voted to endorse Black Lives Matter, which is explicitly a movement to address the unnecessary use of police force, particularly against Black bodies. So here we have our senators working hard to craft a legislation which is in time with the moment, and then my union is voting against it. So this... So I contacted the chair of the VSEA Legislative Committee, Margaret Crowley, and they had not endorsed that position. So what we had was a kind of a rogue executive move. I'm not sure how it happened within the union to resist basically a piece of civil rights legislation. Now, mind you, the police can negotiate working conditions, but the right to strangle somebody is not a working condition issue. It's an issue of criminality. So we don't think that criminal behavior is something you can negotiate and bargain for. It's just antithetical to unionism, which is really about what's good for everyone, including union members who are often the victims of unnecessary police violence during strikes and things like that. So I was disturbed by this, and so I am working with union brothers and sisters to try to have the board address where was the breakdown in the union so that here we are testifying against what I think is really important anti-racist legislation. And I really appreciate the senators who voted for it.
John Howe, I got to interrupt you and ask you were talking on Facebook, I think, about actually demonstrating, protesting in front of the VSEA headquarters on State Street in Montpelier. Have you done that yet?
No, that was a reaction to my exuberance, just my shock.
Okay, so you're not planning on holding a demonstration outside VSEA headquarters anymore?
Not yet. I have hope that the board will redress this immediately.
And by the way, I should say, I did this in the first few minutes of the program this morning, but I should say that I did reach out to the VSEA leadership yesterday. The first reaction was to ask me who else I was having on, and before I had a chance to get back to them and answer that question, they then declined to participate today. So I just want to, you know, when I reach out to folks, give them a chance, and they do not want to participate, I do tend to mention that because I want to make sure that listeners understand that I am trying to get all sides of the story here, and sometimes
I appreciate you know, that, Dave. And I think you're showing the division within the BSEA. We have a lot of very conservative people who struggle with Black mm-hmm. Lives Matter. We've had arguments, and we've tried many times to get an endorsement for BLM, and finally it came through. We struggle like a good portion of the population to understand how we are implicit in sustaining systematic racism. Why Vermont right. has the same problems that other states have, and so many of us are active in trying to make change.
Let me ask Senator Sears while we still have him. Senator, yep. have you ever seen a case where, you know, you're getting testimony from some members of the VSEA, but there's significant division within the union's ranks on an issue before your committee? Have you ever seen that before?
Not very often. I think that by and large, the VSEA has done a terrific job of advocating for state employees. I do think in this particular case there should have, if Mr. Bloom, I believe, was speaking, he said on his own behalf and not of the union during the testimony in the Senate Judiciary Committee. So I'm not completely sure he was speaking on behalf of the union. But I do know that in many cases, and certainly, Colonel Birmingham of the Vermont State Police, Mike O'Neill, the lobbyist for the Vermont Troopers Association, were generally supportive of the effort here, and
of this legislation.
They didn't come out and oppose it. They had some concerns about the criminalization, similar to what was expressed by Mr. Bloom, but they did not come out and oppose it. And I think that's important to note here. So I realize what your other guest is saying, and I really do appreciate his support for this legislation. And I appreciate him. I'm a 70-some-odd-year-old white guy, and we all have our biases, and we know that. It's trying to deal with them and trying to understand from a different perspective what the experience is for the person who's confronted with these situations.
Yeah, yeah. Hey, we do have a caller on the line. I believe Fred from Newbury is with us. Good morning, Fred.
Morning. Hey, there must be some extenuating circumstances that allow a police officer to use a chokehold. I can give one maybe, perhaps, and that is the police officer by himself. And he's attacked by a suspect, and they start to ground grapple. That's very dangerous. And the quickest and the easiest way to get control over somebody is a chokehold. It's a lot easier than putting an arm bar on the guy or trying to pull your knife on him or even your gun.
Okay, well, let's see. John Howe, what do you think of that sentiment? John, are you still with us?
Yeah. So I did read about that. It's like I think we open the door. A lot of these rules open the door, have consistently been opening the door for police to use unnecessary force. And I think a lot, it goes back to other areas where the situation escalates because of poor policing. And so then the use of force becomes necessary. As I've looked at videos, and I'm not an expert in police tactics, I think by having a law that allows loopholes or using the neck hold, it always gets argued in court that police felt threatened, therefore they're justified in the use of force. And then it comes down to a jury making a decision. And then if the law is not very strong, it always favors the police. So
all right, well, you know what,
yeah,
I hate to interrupt, but I am about out of time for this segment. I really appreciate Senator Richard Sears, Dick Sears, a Democrat of Bennington County, chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee, has been my guest for these 45 minutes. Thank you very much, Senator.
Thank you, David. I appreciate the interest in this bill.
Already.
Wish you well.
Yep.
Thank you.
Thank you. You too. John Howe, thanks for checking in with us and giving your point
you
of view.
So yep.
Yep. And I did, as I mentioned, reach out to VSEA and Mr. Bloom himself, had a long chat with him yesterday, got some good perspective on this topic. He wasn't able to join us this morning. I wish that were the case, but unfortunately, sometimes these things just don't work out. So we are going to shift our attention right now to NASCAR and the case perhaps of Bubba Wallace, the only black driver in the NASCAR circuit. He is someone who has been actually made a complaint to law enforcement that there was a noose found in the garage to which he was assigned by NASCAR, and he obviously concluded this was a racist incident directed at him. NASCAR's only black driver. Meanwhile, NASCAR has been in the news lately because it is trying to, I guess, reform its ways to some extent. The display of Confederate flags at NASCAR events has been banned. And we are very lucky at WDEV. We have in our own ranks, in fact, the senior most member of our own ranks, longtime station owner Ken Squire, is somebody who has long maintained another career in addition to his work as owner of this radio station. He has been an announcer and a broadcaster at NASCAR events. And Ken Squire joins us this morning to talk about what's been going on in the car racing world in the United States in the last several weeks here. Good morning, Ken. Thanks for joining me.
Thank you.
So tell us a little bit about what is going on with NASCAR these days. I'm sure I missed some of the nuances here and even some of the basic facts as well. So fill us in.
Well, I guess it's like everything else in the world today. We think we have a handle on it, and then it wobbles away in another direction.
Yeah.
NASCAR has been seeking a way to get itself more in tune with where America is at, and they've really been working very hard at it. And then they had this young driver come along who's got several years of experience. Richard Petty took a chance on him, and of course he is the king, 200-time winner, and the 82-year-old said, I think I want to try him. And he put him in his car, and lo and behold, he's crashed a lot of cars. That's not indicative of trouble. That's usually somebody who's too anxious and excited to get going that gets going, and things fall apart on him a little. But he's improved over a year so incredibly. You can only think the closest comparison is when Jeff Gordon came along from California, and he wrecked everything he had. But he came on to be one of the greatest champions that NASCAR has had when it settled down.
This case,
we got a driver who is black or semi-black. His dad and mother are from two different parts of the world. And he is very seriously interested in improving not only his position, but that of NASCAR. And NASCAR for years has been a sign because it came out of the Southeast, born in Georgia and North Carolina and South Carolina, as very racist. And at one time it was, no question about it, because it was a rural sport. And we know a lot about that in Vermont. We never were that far along that we were racist about it, I don't think. But we were a rural sport here in Vermont. 23 tracks around the Green Mountain State that provided entertainment and excitement and competition back after World War II. That's changed a lot now. But it's the same flavor as what they had in the South, minus this issue that has come back around. And thank goodness we've got a young driver, this Wallace, who's willing to stand up and say we don't need some of the things that we've carried from the very beginning. Good color.
Bubba Wallace is the driver. He's 26 years old, and how's he doing on the circuit? Is he winning some races?
No, No. Well, he's been winning some, not in the major circuit. He's been winning some and looking better in this past weekend in Talladega, Alabama, on that 197-mile-an-hour track continuously. He ran with the leaders all day and at one time led the race. But that's not indicative of a win when you're running against the very best.
Seems as though
that he's almost on a breakthrough spot. We'll see what happens next in that case. But in this case, that noose that was found in number four part of the pit area in the garage has become a cause célèbre, and apparently FBI got in there with the local police, and they're of the opinion that that story did not exist. They thought they found a noose, but it didn't hang up right, that's for sure. And so we're past that, and it's really bothered Wallace dramatically, because everybody in NASCAR, all the drivers, all the crew chiefs, all the mechanics, they came up in strong support, as they indicated at Talladega last weekend. And prior to the race, they marched out his car, and they marched behind it to the pit road. It was a great show of a difference of opinion in NASCAR from what we've seen before, and a healthy one. Well, now we're stuck with this conundrum as to how that happened, and there's a lot of conjecture, because no one is really allowed in that garage area these days, as to how that thing got there.
Yeah, I was reading up on this a little bit this morning before our conversation, Ken, and apparently the uncertainty here is the FBI has concluded that this looped rope, which Bubba Wallace believes, and by the way, Bubba Wallace apparently had not seen it himself. He had seen photographs of it, so he might be describing it from the photographs, but he's certain it's a noose, and you know, the FBI is saying actually it was a garage door pull. I guess picture sort of a rope hanging from a garage door. You might grab to pull the door down, you know, and the FBI looked at it and said basically no noose is good noose, right? I mean, and the driver, Bubba Wallace, is saying, come on, don't give us this line of organic fertilizer here, right? And that's where we are, it seems. I mean, I, according to the stories that are out and about just this morning. And so I don't know whether there'll ever be any resolution as to whether this item was a noose or a garage door pull. But but meanwhile, NASCAR has taken other steps, Ken, and we only have a couple of minutes to go. Maybe you could tell us, do I understand correctly that that they've actually issued a ban on Confederate flags at their events?
Totally. Yep. Long time coming. Should have happened years and years ago. And it just was not one of the considerations. And they were trying to keep the sport going, and they didn't pay that much attention to it. And perhaps they should have. And that's taken care of, all thanks to Bubba Wallace. He didn't like the offensive idea of those Confederate flags. And when all the trouble about statues came up, he brought this forward and said, we don't need them in the infield at the places we run in. He, being the singular driver that was of the blacks, that's a little different from some of the past, and we remember some other black drivers that had been there. But economically, it's a tough sport and very expensive, and that never worked out. So now they've got a real shot with a kid getting support from Richard Petty, and the ally is as strong as anybody in the country as far as motorsports is concerned.
Yep.
And they are really evolving NASCAR from its old boy standard of many, many years into something far better.
Well, that's hopeful. I guess that's the best way to describe it.
That is
hopeful, and let's hope that if this was a noose, that no more incidents like that occur, or that if this was a noose, that the perpetrator of placing it there is found and faces some accountability for that. And meanwhile, Ken Squire, longtime NASCAR broadcaster and racing expert and longtime owner of WDEV, has been my guest the last few minutes. Ken, thank you very much for joining me. It's great talking with you on our air.
Glad to do it.
Alrighty, we are going to head into a top of the hour break in just a couple minutes for some CBS News and some words from our sponsors. And meanwhile, I want to remind you all that this being a Wednesday, we are going to have one of our live news conferences with Governor Phil Scott and other top state officials right after the end of the Dave Graham Show here on WDEV FM and AM. Just after 11 o'clock, we'll go to some CBS News and then to the governor's news conference. And we, meanwhile, are going to take a break right now for a few minutes and be back shortly, folks. Stay with us.
This is WDEV News Radio, owned and operated by the Radio Vermont Group. From the top of Sugarbush, 96.1 WDEV FM, Warren and Waitsfield, 96.5 W243 Barrie, 98.3 W252 CU Montpelier, along with our founding station, AM 550 WDEV Waterbury Montpelier. Streaming at WDEVradio.com. 88 years of serving Vermont. The friendly.
We're opening upstairs at the Warren Store. Following CDC guidelines, we will allow 3 people at a time from 10 to 4 Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, and 11 to 3 Monday and Thursday until further notice. Or you can email Lori, L-O-R-I, at warrenstore.com to make an appointment. There's lots of great summer clothing at 50% off outside and new spring merchandise upstairs. Please wear a mask. We have disposables, and we will be selling organic wired ones from Product Think Tank. We'd love to see you. Stay safe. Main Street, Warren Village.
Now back to the Dave Graham Show on WDEV, FM, and AM.
We're back and continuing into our second hour on this Wednesday morning, June the 24th, 2020. I'm joined now by Paul Vialis of CBS News. He is the network's law enforcement expert. And Paul, thank you very much for joining me this morning.
My pleasure, Dave. How are you this morning?
I'm doing all right, and I wanted to get you on the air this morning because there's a lot of work going on in Congress right now relating to police reform, basically, and it looks like, as usual, this is Congress we're talking about here, folks. Republicans and Democrats are sharply divided on what approaches to take. Fill us in on what's happening down there.
Well, I can tell you I don't think much is happening right now, Dave, to tell you the truth, and I really don't believe that anything's going to come out of this that's going to appease or actually, you know, just make the American public feel better about where we are right now. I really don't see that coming from Washington, D.C.
Interestingly, some state legislatures are tackling police reform right now, and included in them are Vermont's legislature. In fact, in the first hour of the program this morning, I had a couple guests talking about a potential ban on the use of chokeholds by police officers in our state, and a criminal penalty, a possible 20-year prison sentence for those convicted. Obviously, the debate is centering on some of the law enforcement folks are saying, you know, this would be a very rare thing, but if you're in a grapple with a suspect and your firearm has come out of its holster, it's on the ground or something, he's reaching for it, you're reaching for it, you might want to put your hands on his throat to keep him away from it or something, and then you're technically violating the chokehold law. What do you make of this whole debate here?
Again, you know, what we need to do is the American public needs to understand several things. And I don't think that in the media we've done a very good job at educating the American public. I think we've done a great job at sensationalizing. So when we break this down, understand that there is something called the use of force matrix, and that is what governs how and when police can use whatever force they feel they need necessary to control the situation. That goes, Dave, from verbal commands all the way up to deadly physical force. Now, part of that, and this is consistent in every state in the United States, part of that also spells out that a police officer has the right to exercise one level higher force than that force being projected at him or at her. That has been in place for the last three decades plus, and that is what stands today. And then you have state statute. That's going to vary from state to state as to what, when an officer can use deadly physical force and what has to be presented to them. Are they in fear of great bodily injury, or are they in great fear, or are they in fear of death, or both? That varies from state to state. When we look at a chokehold, by means of defensive tactics training, police are taught not to use a chokehold, unless, of course, you in situations, in dire situations where fear of death is imminent, as you pointed out, you're grappling on the ground, someone has taken your gun. The only way that you can survive this is do whatever you can at that moment to survive it, and if that includes a chokehold, fine. You can articulate that in court later on by the means of force used, because clearly you can prove that you were in fear of death, or the individual would take the gun and go and leave and possibly hurt somebody else in the community. So there are a lot of things that need to come into play here before we can start legislating and putting in a nice, neat box what force police can use and when they can use it.
Yeah, I mean, it strikes me that in non-police work, in just, you know, a fight between two individuals of you know, whoever they are, you have legal doctrine called self-defense, where basically if you feel like your life is in imminent danger and you take steps that end up resulting in severe bodily injury or death to the person who from whom you perceive this threat, you are very potentially likely even exonerated, right?
Well, exactly. You got to remember, I mean, police have a scale of what they can use and when they can use it. They know that. They're taught that. Now, are there instances where there are police that have used excessive force? There's no question about that. Everyone admits that. There's no question. It's not condoned, and nor should it ever be condoned. But to be able to say that we're going to have, on a national basis, we're going to fit police work into a nice, neat box, unfortunately, Dave, it's unrealistic. That's like saying every community in Vermont should be policed the same way. That's just unrealistic. We know that. You know that. Policing is about being representative of the demographic of the community you serve. That's key. I don't think that we're there right now in the country. In fact, I know we're not. And that's so much at the root cause of what we're seeing today.
Yeah, well, I guess that is that institutional level reform may be what it sounds like you would put a higher priority on that than you would on sort of tactical reform right now.
Well, I mean, tactical reform comes with it, but before we can, we have to look at the totality of the problem, Dave. And part of that is we have to ask ourselves, are we putting the right people in a police uniform? And that goes to police leadership. That goes to the funding that goes to police relative to the recruitment. How much are you really recruiting in the community to get your community involved in their own policing? That's a big step. We have to go through that post-Rodney King. We need to do that again today. And then the selection procedure. How strict is it? And what's the psychological testing like? Examine those things, because they, you will find, after an excessive force case, many of these elements of behavior could have been identified in the early stages, from selection to training. So it's not a really quick answer, but it can be a concise answer if we look at the totality of the issue, and that starts with recruitment, selection, and then into training, and then implementation.
Paul, last week we spoke and we were talking about, we got into part of the conversation which we kind of compared the officer's conduct in the case in Atlanta that resulted in the death of an unarmed black man down there, and of course the George Floyd case in Minneapolis. And I wondered, from what you were telling me, I asked you kind of relative culpability of the two different officers here, one in Atlanta, right, one in Minneapolis, and you seemed pretty clear that you thought that the officer in Atlanta was significantly less culpable than this Derek Chauvin out in Minnesota.
Correct.
And now we have the officer in Atlanta has been indicted for murder. And I'm wondering, are you surprised by that? Do you think it'll hold up? And are there new elements or sort of new knowledge about this case or a new focus on the fact that the man who was killed and was shot in the back? Any of those elements maybe coming more to the fore now? Talk to me a little bit about how this is shaping up.
Okay, well, Dave, again, there is a gross disparity between Minneapolis and Atlanta. But as we dissect Atlanta, let's understand what we're looking at. But let me answer your question first. Am I surprised? No. The district attorney in Atlanta, to me, is clearly guilty of prosecutorial grandstanding. I mean, he's got one of the finest law enforcement agencies at his beck and call, the Georgia Bureau of Investigation. They're not even halfway finished with their investigation, and he's already moving towards 11 criminal charges. Now, to me, that makes absolutely no sense. But let's spin this out a little bit, and let's break this down. Think about what happened. You have a minor DUI arrest that turns into two counts of battery on a law enforcement officer, and then an armed robbery where the suspect steals a deadly weapon. Now, in the state of Georgia, a taser is considered a deadly weapon by law. So now you have an incident that went from a minor DUI arrest to a fleeing felon that just committed three felonies and is armed with a deadly weapon and has shot at a police officer. You put this together by law, by police procedure, and clearly that's a justified shooting. It's justified use of force. The DEA he's going to have to own the responsibility that when they acquit this cop, which they will, and if they don't, he'll win on appeal, then they will burn down Atlanta. And I'm telling you right now, he did no one any justice whatsoever by the decision that he made.
All right. Well, Paul Vialis of CBS News, I really appreciate you joining us this morning. Always good talking with you. Thanks so much.
My pleasure, Dave. Have a great day.
You too. So with the CBS News correspondents here, those guys are incredibly busy. They're doing interviews with radio stations around the country. I can't keep them on long, unfortunately. And so sometimes what happens is, like today, right toward the end of the interview with the CBS News person, I get notified that there's a caller on the line. Listeners, if you want to ask a question of the CBS News person, it is tough because really pretty much limited to 5 minutes or so. But I'm happy to try to get your question on the air anyway, and maybe try to take a stab at it myself or as well, leave it open sometimes for other listeners to chime in if they have better information than your limited host of the Dave Graham Show here on WDEV FM and AM. All that said, let's bring in Don from Elmore. Good morning, Don.
Good morning, Dave. I'm sorry your guest escaped so fast, too.
Well, However, as I say, that kind of has to happen.
I understand that.
Yeah.
He mentioned psychology in his comment.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. And I think the real place the psychology needs to come in today is in the testing of police officers before they're hired. The officer in Atlanta that shot the man in his back twice has been cited before. I believe there are two times when he was cited. One of them, I think, has yet to be decided. But you take a look at a photograph of the two of those individuals that shot this man. There's something wrong there. There's really something wrong here, and I will let it go with that.
Okay.
But at the same I'd like to see your correspondent spend a little time in moot court down at Vermont Law School or something, because I don't think he'd do very well.
There are several
instances here. He's citing the fact that the state's attorney did not wait for the Georgia Bureau of Investigation's report. Why should he?
Yeah.
He has dozens of films of this event. It's pretty clear what happened. I am a conservative Goldwater Republican, but I think the man has done the exact right thing in filing the charges that he has made. This was clearly a case of murder by cop in my mind, and there's just no way around it. Plus the fact that when you have the Georgia Bureau of Investigation investigating a murder by a police officer, you've got the fox watching the chicken coop. What are they going to do? You think they're going to come out and testify against another police officer?
Well, I mean,
hopefully they're honest enough and they can see the films and will, but I question the whole doggone thing.
Yeah, I get you, Don. I know that's frequently a problem, is that people talk about the thin blue line and how, you know, law enforcement officers tend to back each other up, and it's probably human nature. You feel like you're a part of a group which is under siege, and so you.
Well, but
you,
that's what you, I say. We need a lot more psychological testing before somebody's brought on a police force, and we certainly need a lot better training in that regard. When I was a youngster and involved with the Boy Scouts, we had a good rifle team, if you will, and we were well involved with our town police force. And we had safety measures and what was allowed and what wasn't allowed drilled into our heads repeatedly. The one thing I can remember out of that was that there were only five instances in that time when a police officer was allowed to remove his weapon from its holster. Whatever happened to those regulations? Today, they seem to have gone out the window, and any time a cop gets concerned about something, the first thing he does is pull his revolver out or his semi-automatic pistol. You know, again, your correspondent from CBS was saying that a taser is a deadly weapon. I'm sorry, that's not the way it has come down in court. It is not a deadly weapon.
Yeah, that's an interesting point.
I'd love to see him in moot court down in Vermont law for a couple of terms.
Yeah. I do think there are other instances in which people make the claim that a taser is not a deadly weapon, because that conclusion might work in their favor. So that's something to be sorted out at some point, maybe by the day.
That's it.
Yeah.
And here we have the two police officers saying that he had turned and was going to use the taser on them. And apparently this is not backed up by many of the videos that people have seen. He was shot in the back. I mean, to me, there's no excuse for that. I do not excuse these people tearing down statues and things like that. Yep. And there's one place, probably one of the few, where I agree with Trump. They should be charged and prosecuted. It's damage to public property.
Yeah. Don, I got to go, but I thank you for the call, and it's always good chatting with you. Thanks. Checking again soon. All right. Well, let's get into this topic of ATV safety here on the Dave Graham Show. I saw a really interesting announcement out on Monday, kind of a worrisome announcement, frankly, from the University of Vermont Medical Center. And it quoted an official there by the name of Abby Bierman, who was the injury prevention specialist. Boy, that seems to be hard for me to say this morning. I'll see if I can smooth it out over the next few minutes here. Injury prevention specialist with the University of Vermont Medical Center. And she was talking about a sharp increase in the number of ATV accidents resulting in hospitalizations, and then listed some safety tips for folks. I thought I'd get Ms. Bierman on the program here and talk about a little bit about this topic, along with Danny Hale, who is the president of the Vermont Association of, I'm sorry, the Vermont ATV Sportsmen's Association, and the two of them are my guests here on the Dave Graham Show. Abby and Danny, thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you for inviting us to be here today.
Sure. Abby, I'm going to let you go first, because you kind of did with this statement that the hospital issued on Monday. Big increase in ATV accidents resulting in hospitalizations. What have you found?
So I work specifically with our trauma center, so we're seeing the patients that aren't just the little scrapes or bruises. We're seeing people who have been seriously injured. And our ATV numbers are over three times higher than they were this time last year. Pediatric increase is even higher. That's close to five times more.
Wow, that is disturbing. And so what are the raw numbers? Can you give us a sense of that?
Yeah.
And this is through the end of May, I guess, is that right?
Yeah, through the end of May, we had seen 17 individuals already, where in previous years we usually were only seeing four or six cases at that point, and we've had many more in June, to the point where I've had know, nurses and doctors reaching out to me going like, hey, we keep seeing ETV patients. You know, this seems really unusual. Has there been an increase? So, I mean, at every level of our institution, people are taking notice of this.
Yeah, so these are not statewide figures. These are actually just figures for the UVM Medical Center?
Yeah, so these are just the numbers for our trauma center. So,
I see. Okay. I don't know. Have you looked into, I mean, if somebody gets in an accident of any kind down in the Connecticut River Valley, I would think they're typically going to go to Dartmouth just because it's a lot closer. Or if they're down in the Brattleboro area, let's say, they might go to Bay State Medical Center down in, or maybe to Boston or something. We don't have the complete statewide picture here, I guess, is what you're saying. But have you heard anything about what is going on elsewhere in Vermont?
Yeah, so there's definitely been some concern that I've heard. And our assumption is if we're already seeing a spike like this at our trauma center, that we're assuming there's a lot more going on in the community.
Yeah. Now, Danny Hale, who is the president of the Vermont ATV Sportsmen's Association, thank you very much for joining me. I gather this is not a happy topic for you, and I appreciate your willingness to come on and sort of talk about this. But let me ask you. We spoke, I think this morning it was, and you were telling me that there's been a really large increase in the number of people using ATVs in Vermont. Is that right?
Yes, David, and thank you for letting me be on the show today. This spring has been a great spring for people to want to get out and do things that they could do alone, and it resulted in a very, very prosperous spring for the ATV dealers. Many units sold, completely out. So that's one thing about this, the injuries. I should say that there certainly have been some assumptions made that this is a statewide thing. We have not heard through our channels, including law enforcement, of a large increase in accidents. We have heard about a large increase in users, which would help. Unfortunately, the results of that would potentially be an increase in the number of actual accidents. We try to follow every example of safety and good behavior with our membership and support the UVM's effort here, but we just haven't seen a large increase, again, through our data that we get working with law enforcement in our...
Hey, Danny Hale and Abby Bierman, we need to go to a bottom 8-hour break for some CBS News and a couple of words from our sponsors. We'll talk more about what some of the safety tips are and what you're telling folks about. If you're going to ride ATV, here's what you need to do after the break. Stay with us, folks.
We're opening upstairs at the Warren Store. Following CDC guidelines, we will allow 3 people at a time from 10 to 4 Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, and 11 to 3 Monday and Thursday until further notice. Or you can email Lori, L-O-R-I, at warrenstore.com to make an appointment. There's lots of great summer clothing at 50% off outside and new spring merchandise upstairs. Please wear a mask. We have disposables, and we will be selling organic wired ones from Product Think Tank. We'd love to see you. Stay safe. Main Street, Warren Village.
News Radio, WDEV, FM, and AM. Now back to the Dave Graham Show.
Continuing our conversation with Abby Bierman and the University of Vermont Medical Center. She's an injury prevention specialist. See there, that time I said it smoothly. And also Danny Hale, he's with the Vermont ATV Sportsman's Association. And we are talking about what appears to be, from the stats being kept at Vermont's tertiary care hospital there in Burlington, the UVMMC, it's a big spike in serious injuries resulting from ATV accidents. We had a fatality just earlier this month, I know of, in our own central Vermont area. A young woman from Barrie was killed in an ATV accident over in Orange. And Danny Hale, this is pretty risky stuff, isn't it? I mean, you know, you're When you get out on one of these machines, it's not like a typical car where you have, you know, airbags and just the corner beams of the car and the roof and all this stuff and the big, you know, heavy engine. If you hit something, it's going to be absorbing some of the shock in front of you and et cetera. So this is a whole different story, isn't it? Danny Hale, you're still with us. Let's see here. Maybe not. I actually just got a message that said, call dropped me, so maybe we ought to try getting that restored. Meanwhile, I do hope and believe that Abby Bierman is still with us. Abby, is that right?
Yes, I am.
Okay, great. Well, maybe I'll get you to answer the same question. Obviously, the risk profile of just a trip on an ATV is automatically higher than it is, say, in a regular sedan or SUV or whatever, because you don't have all of the things I mentioned surrounding you on an ATV that you would have in a car.
Yeah, with any kind of motorized equipment, whether that's mm-hmm. a car, a boat, an ATV, there's definitely ways you can keep yourself safer, whether that is the safety equipment you wear, behaviors you follow. But the nice thing is some of those kind of ways to prevent these crashes is the fact that there's things that people can do to keep themselves safer.
And talk to me a little bit about, you listed some of them the other day, but fill our listeners in. What were the items on your list?
Now, one of the things that, I know the Vermont ATV Sportsman Association does require, a helmet's required on all VASA trails in Vermont, mm-hmm. which we love. But the thing we noticed was that when people were admitted to the trauma service for ATV-related injuries is that the helmet usage was really low among those patients. We're talking about only about 25 to 33% of patients were actually wearing a helmet at the time of their injury.
Wow. So, I'm curious now, most of these injuries coming in to your hospital, were they using VASA trails or were they kind of on their own property or on other trails and so on around the state?
Yeah, unfortunately, we don't find out, just from our basic list, if they were on a VASA mm-hmm. trail or not. We usually know if they were in a wilderness area or on a yard or on a road. We do see a decent number that are on private property. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if those are VASA trails or not. That's definitely something would be interesting to find out.
Yeah, I think that would actually be an important piece of research, maybe for VASA itself, to find out, of these injuries. Danny Hale, you fell off on the phone situation for a few minutes, and I apologize if it was on our end or either way, actually. But that's the nature of communication sometimes. And I just wanted to fill you in on sort of where this conversation has been going. And Abby and I were talking about the fact that on VASA trails, and she's very complimentary about this, that on your trails you require riders to wear helmets, right?
Yes, we do. Everything inside the VASA, you're supposed to have a helmet on.
Yeah, and I would think that's pretty basic common sense that you want to do that wherever you're riding an ATV. But Abby was saying that only a quarter to a third of the folks that are coming in with serious injuries were wearing a helmet at the time of the accident, and that led me to the question of, do we think, or I was asking, for the breakdown in terms of these accidents, what numbers were the people on VASA trails versus what numbers of them were on their own, on other private property or on roads or on any number of other places around the state where we sometimes see people on ATVs. And do you have any sense of that?
I don't have any official numbers, but I have been in a leadership position for 20 years in the ATV movement here in Vermont, and certainly my what I've seen is a lot of them are not, most of them are not on VASA trail. They are either on private property under with the owner's consent, or they're on a public right of way that is open to ATV use, be it a Class 4 road or something of that nature.
I see.
The other thing that's increased dramatically in the past few years is the assumption that because you have a what we classify as a side-by-side, where you sit side-by-side versus the traditional straddle ATV, folks have the misconception that if they're in that, then with a roll cage, then they don't need to wear a helmet. And unfortunately, that's not the truth. At that point, once you're inches away from that steel roll cage, you, in fact, are more likely to get a head injury without being thrown from the unit because you get thrown around within the seat. So those things combined, again, lead BASA to support, including supporting legislation to make helmets mandatory in Vermont.
Wow. Okay. And so you would like to see helmets worn by riders on ATVs, not just on your trails, but everywhere in the state.
Certainly, when you're recreational riding. Now, if you're just pulling, your ATV around your lawn at a very, very low rate of speed and using it in a utility manner, there's some movement there where you may not need to. But certainly, if you're doing any type of recreational riding, trail riding. Certainly anything to do with a lot of the roads that are now open by communities, anything of that nature, you need to wear a helmet all the time.
Right, yeah. And of course, we should mention ATVs often are used as an important sort of, as you put it, utility or service vehicles where, you need to pull some equipment out to a section of your property that would be a long way to carry it. So you put it in maybe a little trailer, hook it to the back of your ATV, and off you go. And that is a different animal of usage, I would think, than it's more toward farming or just property, maybe some wood forest maintenance and that kind of thing. Although even in that case, Abby, I would think you would like to see people wear helmets even if they're heading out to just do chores.
Yeah, I know we're definitely digging down to better understand what people are doing at the time of injury, but I mean, ATVs are large vehicles. I mean, even if I'm just moving my car, down my driveway, I'm still probably going to put my seatbelt on.
You're an injury prevention specialist, so I can. I don't mean to laugh, but I don't know why that sort of cracked me up. But actually, the truth is, I probably do it just out of habit. And in fact, I remember one time a few years ago. I live on this little back street in Montpelier, and I got to the bottom of my street, and I suddenly had the sensation of sort of feeling naked or something, and I looked, I said, oh, I forgot to buckle my seatbelt, and I immediately buckled my seatbelt, but you develop these habits, and that's actually the best way to maintain safety is to have these behaviors kind of come to you and happen without a whole lot of thought on a daily basis, right?
Exactly. If you normally wear a helmet, even if you're just hauling something across your property, you're going to always remember it when you're doing something else. Plus, even if you're just planning to go to the back, maybe you run into a friend who's going by on a trail and they want you to join them. I know I usually get distracted when I'm saying I'm only going to do this one thing really quick. So always having that safety equipment with you in case that plan changes is always important.
Yeah, that's an interesting point there. Abby, I also wanted to continue maybe to the next item on your list. You say always wear a helmet. Let's see here. What else do we have here? Oh, fit the ATV to the rider.
Yeah. So, sure, Dan could probably speak more to the different styles of ATVs than I could, given his expertise. But, the American Association of Pediatrics says that if children are too young to have a driver's license, they should probably not be operating or riding in any kind of vehicle. But at the same time, they do design ATVs in different sizes so that they can better be controlled and ridden by their users. So making sure that the ATV is properly fitted to the driver and making sure that, if you're riding like a two-person ATV, ensuring that both individuals are old enough to safely ride it and we're wearing the proper safety equipment is also important.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Danny, what do you think? Would that be a good rule, or is there a rule right now that says you know, when you're out, when you're going to take kids, especially out on an ATV or even a small adult, you know, some adults are pretty slight in size. Fit the machine to the rider. What do you make of that?
Well, I think that's great. That has been what we've been trying to accomplish in the OHV world for a number of years, is to make sure that people are on the right size machine, have the right size, the right amount of safety knowledge, and adhere to all of the basic safety, helmet, gloves, eyewear, long pants, long sleeves. We promote that stuff within our organization every day.
Yep.
You know, safety is one of the top priorities of our organization, and you know, we provide safety courses for children, we provide education for adults, and a lot of that comes through the dealerships, and we try to make it as safe as we can. That's, you know, that's our goal as well.
Yeah, that is I'm sure. I mean, it's sort of common sense almost. When you're going out to shop for a bicycle, you want to get the right size bicycle. So you know, otherwise you can have somebody whose legs, you know, barely reach the pedals, and they're more prone to having accidents on the bicycle. So that's always an issue. I mean, the hard part I would imagine is that these ATV, the machines are not cheap, and so the idea that I'm going to suddenly have if I have you know, four kids and ranging in age from you know 10 to 20 or something, I'm probably not going to have the wherewithal to have a fleet in different sizes, am I?
No, and honestly, today's market is in the side-by-side, the family, the family travels in one unit, more likely
yep.
now than individual ATVs.
Right.
Years ago, we used to all ride individual ATVs. The current market, these folks are buying, you know, four-seaters where everyone's in the same unit. So.
Yeah,
we're finding less by statute in Vermont, between the ages of 12 and 18, you need mm-hmm. to have a safety certificate. So we provide that through hands-on classes, classroom-type classes, and it's available online. And we're seeing a pretty dramatic reduction in folks actually letting, you know, getting their kids started early. They're riders,
yep.
not passengers, hey, not drivers.
Want to bring in a listener who's on the line, Vic from Middlesex. Good morning, Vic.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Hey, I think Mr. Hale there started to say something. There's a lot of difference. Here again, it's like a lot of things we do today. We lump everything together and you know, ATV is everything. And, of course, there's UTVs. There's the four-wheeler that's a personal, pretty much one or two persons on it. You got the UTVs that are mostly side-by-side. You've got front seats, back seats. You got UTVs with bucket seats that have tremendous horsepower and are made for, like, racing around. So I think it's important to differentiate what you're talking about. And I think that, you know, this, you know, I got a little excited when I got to wear a helmet when I pull my little UTV, which is a four wheel thing with a snowplow on it. And I have to put my helmet on just plow my driveway. And I think, I don't know how you would enforce it on your own private land. I don't know how that one would do. But with that said, I'd also like to ask the young lady there, I apologize for forgetting your name, but
Abby Bierman.
Do you have any statistics on how, on these accidents and these accidents that happen, how many times alcohol or drugs is involved in the or the person is under the influence of either?
Really good question, Vic. Thank you very much. Abby, take it away.
Yeah, so we have found that in about half of the adult cases, alcohol appears to be a factor at some level.
Yeah, that is a that's a factor in many of these instances. So some of the hazards that you mentioned in one of the safety tips there, I should just summarize first. There's an important safety tip, which is that when you're going to head out on the trail, Do a little advanced scouting, especially if you're thinking about heading out there at high speed. Figure out what hazards might exist. Are there ditches that could interfere with your travels? And sometimes they appear, you know, in a spring melt, in a rush of water. There'll be new hazards that appear in some of these trails and roads out there, the class 4 roads and so on. The one you mentioned just really kind of raises a nightmare scenario, Abby Bierman, and that was sometimes people do put a cable across a trail to mark off a property line, or basically try to enforce a no trespass kind of an order or something. If these cables are you know going to be hit by a rider at high speed, that have you seen any? Has the hospital seen any accidents like that, Abby? Abby Bierman, are you with us? Well, do we have another dropped call? What about Danny Hale? I mean, talk to us about that sort of scouting process there when you're trying to make sure your trails are safe. Danny? Let's see here. We are. Okay. Yeah. Actually, we just have a few minutes to go here, so we're going to try to get our two guests back on the line. I don't know exactly. Maybe we have a cell phone network issue right now. I'm not sure, but I'll recite some of these other safety tips in the meantime, because I did want to get these out there for folks to be considering. They are important to know about here. One is, this talk of, we talked about fitting the ATV to the rider, wearing a helmet, know where you are riding. There are public ATV trails in our region, such as VASA trails in Vermont. If you are riding on private trails or private property, check for hazards and risks, such as laundry lines, cables blocking off trails, or ditches. Doing a safety check every spring after the snow melts and periodically throughout the summer can help keep riders safer. The only time an ATV should be on a road is to cross it. Cross the road in locations where it is safe to do so, and you have good visibility of oncoming traffic from both directions. So not right behind a curve, folks. Danny, is that another tip you like to say? Only cross roads. Only your only time on a road should be to cross it, and only in places with good visibility.
Yes, that's a great safety standard safety idea right there. In Vermont, we do have access to some roads for parts of our trail system. We mm-hmm. use them as connectors to our private property trails. Which certainly that does is exemplify the fact you should be following all the basic safety rules.
Yep. Another tip, supervise young riders. ATVs may be fun to ride, but they are not toys. The American Academy of Pediatrics recommends that children who are too young to have a driver's license not be allowed to operate an off-the-road vehicle. Dress for the ride. Besides a properly fitted helmet, riders should wear long pants over the ankle, boots, long sleeves, gloves, and goggles. Clothing should be well fitted to limit the risk of it catching on surfaces or objects. Take a safety class. Whether you're new to ATVs or have been riding them for decades, it's always a good idea to take a safety course. You may learn new and important safety information. There are ATV safety courses available online or in person for all ages. Stay alert and connected. Don't use alcohol or other substances when riding out there on ATV trails. Hey, we are just about out of time here on the Dave Graham Show. I want to thank my guests very much, Abby Bierman of the University of Vermont Medical Center and Danny Hale of the Vermont ATV Sportsmen's Association. The two of you have been terrific. I'm sorry about a couple of communication glitches there. And perhaps we can talk again next ATV season about how things are going out there. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All righty. Fast approaching the top of the hour, which means I take off the headset here and hand the WDEV airwaves over to Governor Phil Scott and other top officials for the regular Coronavirus 19 response press conference. So stay with us, folks. We'll be, and Arshel will be back tomorrow. Have a good one.